Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 368 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyro, your host once again. And today my guest is Mark Rockwell. Now, Mark was a guest way back on episode 277. And in all honesty and full disclosure, Mark is a friend of mine. I've known him now for the better part of 3 years or so, and always found him to be very well-spoken and introspective about what he does. And what he does is help solo and small firm practitioners. And he comes from a background in business that I think gives him a little different insight. Now, he's an attorney but by trade, but most of his adult life in business. And I think that brings a different approach to the coaching of solo and small firm practitioners. And hopefully you'll get a sense of that when you listen to him again here today. So without any further delay, here's my friend, Mark Rockwell. Mark Rockwell, welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you back with us again for our savvy audience. If you've been keeping track, Mark was here previously on episode 277. So almost 100 episodes ago, back in August of 2021. That was right at the end of the COVID, right?
Oh, gosh. My whole sense of timing is messed up by COVID. I guess it started in
2021, right? March of
2020.
You're probably right. Probably 2020. Anyway, who wants to relive that?
Yeah, nobody.
Right. So in lieu of that, Mark, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, just in real short form, I'm an attorney by background, went into business. I've spent most of my career in real estate development and in healthcare, but have done lots of legal work during that period of time, worked with lots of attorneys, have had a lot of fun in and around the law profession. And when I sold the majority of my healthcare business about 3 years ago, I started coaching, doing professional coaching and mentoring. And it wasn't long until I started getting some calls from attorneys saying, hey, could you come help us? And so I have decided and been very fortunate to work and focus primarily on small to medium-sized law firms over the last couple of years.
Well, I just want to point out the oxymoron of suggesting that you had a lot of fun in and around the legal profession.
Well, hey, I was picking my words wisely. Yeah, it's not all fun. I mean, golly, you're an attorney. You're a fun guy.
Well, I suppose there's some truth to that.
I mean, after all, you play guitar, for pity's sakes. There's more, you know, attorneys are multidimensional, for pity's sakes.
Yeah, well. Yes, well,
I left you speechless, Neil.
I don't know about how multidimensional I am.
Oh, gosh, I saw a YouTube video you told me about of you playing a guitar. I'm beginning to think you're more of a musician, maybe even than an attorney. You seem to love that so much, and you do so well.
Well, I tell you, it's one of those things where, you know, I used to tell folks, law is my fourth career. Now I've started this musical career, I guess. Now that's my fifth career, and I'm just kind of running out of time, days and weekends and months and frankly, years, but it's a great journey to be on. But I was being facetious there. I mean, obviously, you can certainly have fun in and around the law. And I know from talking with you in the past and working with you personally that you really have kind of focused down, niched down, as it were, to working with a lot of solo and small firm practitioners. So what are some of the things that, you have seen now as time has progressed? So, you know, we have that period of time before COVID, during COVID, now after COVID and beyond. What are the challenges, as you see it, that solo and small firm practitioners are facing?
Well, you know, it probably won't come as any surprise. Most law firms are challenged by feeling as though they can charge enough to justify their billable time and hours and see sufficient profit at the end of the month. It's not at all surprising, or maybe it is surprising, how many law firms, by the time they calculate the hours that weren't billed in the month, calculate the hours that weren't collected, that the bottom line in many firms is not where they would like it to be. And so there's a couple, three things that I think drive that, and there's some solutions to it. It's certainly not an easy panacea, but I've come to the realization that for most law firms, for most attorneys, the crux of a lot of their challenges is managing expectations with their clients and having really good upfront conversations and, frankly, creating value so that a client, when they get a $6,000 or an $8,000 or a $10,000 or a $15,000 bill, it doesn't come as a surprise. And furthermore, the client actually feels as though they got great value for the amount that they're paying. And that, I know, may sound kind of peculiar, but it really is true that most attorneys that I work with are very hesitant to charge what they probably should be charging.
Right. Well, you know, I had a mentor one time that said, keep raising your hourly rate until you get pushback from potential clients that you're too expensive. And then you can drop it a bit if you want, but now you know you've maximized the perceived value of your practice. And I thought, you know, that had some merit. It's a good way of figuring out. I know for a fact when I started doing family law, which was my first hourly-based practice area, I know for a fact I was way undercharging. But I did so with a, you know, thoughtful reason in mind, because I was new to the practice area and I wanted, you know, pretty simple cases and pretty easy cases to kind of cut my teeth on and learn the ropes. And I didn't feel like at that point I deserved to charge a premium for that learning experience. But as I got, you know, more accustomed to family law, I followed that mentor's advice and started raising my rates until I got to the point where I figured I was maximizing my value. So that's certainly an approach.
Well, and I think that, well, clearly nobody wants to gouge clients. That's not the point here.
No.
I do think that it is easy to internalize the thinking that a $5,000 or $6,000 bill is going to get pushback. And that's not to be cavalier about someone paying a $6,000 bill, but it is to say that if that client understands the amount of work, time, effort, and complexity of what's involved, and the value that is created, and the headaches, particularly in the estate planning area, the amount of headaches and expense that it's going to save this person down the road, then all of a sudden, a $6,000 or $7,000 bill sounds pretty reasonable. Yeah. And I have known a number of instances where the firm was charging $2,500, $3,500, $3,800. And I remember saying to this particular person, you telling me that you're creating 27 separate documents and you're charging $3,500, it strikes me as being extremely reasonable. And furthermore, one of the things you've got to be careful about is when you undercharge a client, they don't appreciate it. And I don't mean that they are unappreciative people. They just don't have a basis to even understand that they probably should have paid $8,000. You're charging them $3,500. They walk out of your office thinking, wow, you know, $3,500, that was a lot of money. Well, not really. You actually gave them a $5,500 discount and or $4,500 discount, pardon me, and they don't even know that. So they can't appreciate the fact that you're giving them a good deal.
Well, another way to look at that is to look at the inverse situation. The quickest way to lose clients and to have a dwindling practice is for people to walk away and feel they didn't get the value that they paid for.
Well, that's exactly right. And so all the more reason why you need to have, in every instance, and I really stress this with each of my clients, you need to have a real, clear, professional, upfront conversation where you talk through the scope of work, what the client's needs are, what their expectations are, what the fees are going to be, when the money is going to be due, et cetera. I mean, right. Many people, particularly when it's not a business type of legal need, have never worked with an attorney in the past. And it really is incumbent on the attorney to have a very professional one-on-one conversation. And I believe that not only will do two things. One, it will allow a person to charge what they rightfully should be able to charge and not pull their punches and discount their work. And number two, it really will help on collections. That is the other really big problem that a lot of firms have is their AR is 60, 90, 120 days and growing. And I'm sure that you and every other law firm knows that when something gets over 90 days, the chance that you're going to collect 100% on that starts to diminish pretty rapidly.
Yeah. I will tell you that, again, back in my litigation days when I was practicing on an hourly basis, that can get away from you. It got away from me on multiple occasions. And it was a hard lesson to learn that if the client got too far behind, you weren't going to get that money back and you're going to be stuck because you couldn't get out of the case. And so you've now gone from a paying client to a pro bono client. And it was a hard lesson for me to learn. I remember the straw that broke the camel's back was when, you know, I had pretty close to a $30,000 bill on this client who never paid it. And I had to walk away from it because it was stressing me out too much. Could I have gone to collections? Could I have sued for it? Sure, I could have. But I had to look, to be honest, I had to look at myself and say, I let this get away from me. And this is the price. This is the stupid tax, as Mike Brett said to me one time. It's the tax for being stupid here, Neil. And I wouldn't say it was necessarily stupid, but it was, I learned that lesson the hard way.
Well, and furthermore, you're exactly right. And furthermore, if you had spent the time, effort, and energy to go collect the money, the chances are you would have collected only a portion of it. And that would have been earned a second time by all the time you put in trying to pursue it. So it really would have been a bit of a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, it compounds the problem. So, you know, clearly finances are a major pitfall that solo small firm practitioners find. And, you know, do we ever have enough clients? Do we ever have enough income coming in? I think the vast majority of us would say probably not, but that's one challenge to face. What are some of the others you see?
Well, you know, it's interesting to that point when you said, do any of us ever have enough clients? It is true that most firms are always wanting and needing to add more to their client base, but I've actually found a number of situations where law firms actually have an abundant amount of work. And yet the billings are not what they need to be, and the collections are not what they need to be. And so then you go, this is not good.
Yeah,
there's plenty of work.
Yeah, they don't have a client problem. They have a billing and collections problem.
Well, that's exactly right. And so why is it the billing is a problem? A lot, by no means all, but a lot of billing is two things. One, in my opinion, and this is easy for me to say because I'm not billing my time out in 6-minute increments. Two things I believe that drive that. Number one, and maybe it's three, but number one, attorneys oftentimes are not writing down everything concurrent with when they're doing the work. And I understand that it's a pain, but I know several individuals who are absolute experts in this field. And one person told me point blank, she said, you know, in all my years in practice, working with different law firms on the specific billing side, if an attorney doesn't write down everything concurrent with when they're doing it, they will suffer a 20 to 25% reduction in the amount of time they bill. She said, you can take that to the bank. When people say, well, I'll do it at the end of the day, or I'll do it at the end of the week, or whenever, it just is costing you a lot of money. Just a lot of things slip out of your memory. So that's kind of one. Number two is, why aren't they billing more hours? A lot of that is because they're being interrupted. Interruptions, whether it's emails, fellow colleagues, telephone calls, unscheduled client meetings, those are horrifically important and destructive to billable time. And so again, it's easier said than done, but establishing upfront with a client what the ground rules are about scheduling calls, scheduling meetings, getting the work done, getting it done efficiently. If in the course of any day, an attorney loses even 1 hour, and I know there's way more than this, but if you lose even one billable hour a day, and that's not a great deal, but if your production suffers by even that amount, over the course of 10 years, that's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And as a result, you have to step back and go, okay, I've got to have a routine where I can interact with my clients, interact with my colleagues, but have real productive periods during the day when I'm not interrupted, because those interruptions are fatal financially.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always a conundrum to get that work efficiency model to fit, you know, your approach, you know, what you do best, when you do it best, and how you do it best to fit with the environment that you're in, that you've created, and the clientele that you're working with. I think solos and small firm practitioners, you know, on the one hand, they have it a little better because they can structure the environment and the scenarios the way they want so that they can maximize their efficiency. But on the other hand, they're wearing all the hats of everybody in the law firm. And so it's easy to get distracted by a fire over here or a problem over there. So it's a really difficult balancing act. You have to find what works best for you and how you can be most proficient at it.
Yeah, and that is a lifelong challenge, and certainly far easier said than done. And so I don't mean to make it sound like it's just an automatic, but far from it. But it is something that without concerted attention and thought and planning, and frankly, having really given some organizational effort or giving organizational effort to planning your day, finding quiet space to actually do work, controlling your interruptions from I mean, one of the biggest offenders is frankly the email and notifications on both email and on our cell phones. And I'm as guilty as anybody.
I'm terribly guilty.
When something goes ding, 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 I'm going, oh, that must be Neil contacting me. Oh, gosh. Well, I better look at that message.
I will tell you one thing
that's
really surprised me was when I've had this discussion with so many people, when we talk about the methodology for recording your time. And look, this, let me just take a step back for a second. This isn't just if you are billing on an hourly basis. Even if you're doing fixed price work, such as I'm doing estate planning, I still track my time. It's important mm-hmm. to do so because you want to know whether or not you're making money on the fee that you're charging or you're losing money. I mean, I can feel like my flat fee is correct when the customer agrees to it. But then if the work involved in developing that estate plan actually exceeds the cost of that fee, well, then I know something's wrong here. I'm not charging enough or I'm not efficient enough with my time to make that invoice valid.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, LexiClara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I have been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com. So this issue is true for hourly based attorneys or fixed price based attorneys. One of the things that I found true in asking folks, how do you track that time? How do you make sure that you don't have, as you said, the leakage that occurs by sitting down at the end of the day and writing, or more likely,
coming in the next morning and say, okay, now what did I do yesterday before I get started today? What did I do yesterday running that town? Because I don't know if anybody does it at the end of the day after a long day. They're ready to hit happy hour or go pick up the kids or, you know, that kind of thing. And oftentimes it's left to the next day, which means even more leakage. You're like, well, so I ask, what systems are you using? And I'm shocked to find how few systems people do use.
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you should say that. And I will tell you that one idea that occurs to me, and it certainly works for me, and I don't try to hold myself out as a model of exceptional productivity, but if I were an attorney, I think this is where it would start. I would say to myself, okay, I'm not going to try to bill out 2,400 hours a year, which is what some big law firms tell young rookies coming out of law school, which is just
horrendous.
Makes your hair curl when you think about it. Like, oh my God, 2,400 hours a year. That's just unbelievable, but not untrue. So what is a reasonable number? Well, is it 1,500? Is it 1,600? Is it 1,700 hours? My guess is somewhere between 1,800 hours, 1,800 probably being the maximum, is with efficiency, you can achieve some type of life balance. But let's say for sake of discussion, it's 1,600 hours. You map that out as to what that means on an hourly basis or on a daily basis over the course of a year, giving yourself reasonable time off for, you know, Christmas and holidays and travel and all. Sure. And once you determine what that hourly number per day needs to be, then it strikes me that the best way to get your billing to where it needs to be is what you alluded to. Sit down at the end of the day or at the beginning of every day and say, so how many hours did I actually bill yesterday? And let's say you're trying to bill, for sake of argument, 7 hours or 6 hours. How many hours did you actually bill and what was the delta? So if you said your daily goal was to bill 6 hours and you billed 4, then it right then and there, you need to say, so where did those other 2 hours go? Because clearly you were in the office more likely than not, more than 6 hours. You were probably in the office 8, 9, 10 hours. And if you're billing out a couple hours less than your goal, then clearly there are 2, 3, 4 hours a day that are being absorbed into other activities. And it's really important to then stop and say, well, where did that time go? Because until you've actually had that analysis and recognized what those repetitive problems or issues or habits are, life left on autopilot isn't going to change.
No.
What's your reaction? I mean, what do you think is a reasonable daily billing?
See, it's hard for me to answer that question. I think you've done the right analysis for determining if you're billing on an hourly basis. I think that's the proper way, as you suggest, to work backwards from what your ultimate goal is. What I'm looking at more, it's just the geek in me. When I say, what is your system? Like, how are people recording it? Now, I've known a lot of people who say, I have pad of paper next to my computer or on my desk, and whenever I start something, I write it down. Whenever I stop, I write the stop time. I just keep track of it as I go along throughout the day. Me, you know, I'm a tech guy, and I think, pen and paper, really? There's so many other tools available to you. And I have two that I use quite a bit.
Okay.
I, like many, many people, use Clio as my practice management software.
Mm-hmm.
And they have built-in timers. And you can run multiple timers at once. So whenever I start a task associated with the matter that I have already contracted for, whenever I start that task, I start the timer. And sometimes I get distracted and I have to go to a second item. And so I pause that first timer and start a second timer. And every time I have a good 10 or 15 timers on my screen, which tells me I'm kind of fracturing my time. So I keep track of it that way, to be honest with you, Mark. That's my primary system. Now, at the same time, I also use another application called Day One. It's really a journaling application. It's for people to, you know, write their thoughts down like a diary. But you can have it to where every time you start a new paragraph, it puts a timestamp in. And so when I am doing work that's not related to a specific legal matter that I have under contract, so it's overhead, I type it in there rather than on a piece of paper. And that allows me to construct, you know, my billable hours, so to speak. What have I done that directly attributable to work for a client? And what time have I spent that's directly attributable to the growth of my practice? And that's how I keep track of it.
And it sounds like you're pretty happy with Clio.
Very happy with Clio.
Yeah, I have several clients that use Clio, and they are similarly happy. And yes, they find that the tracking the time is relatively easy.
And look,
at the end of the day, management
platforms all have time trackers now. So that's not that unique. One of the things I do like about Clio's is it's inherently easy to put to allocate what that time expense is. I can put it in, I can start a timer, or I can put it in as a 12-minute task, 12 minutes, or 0.5 hours. It recognizes the time division really intuitively. So it makes it really easy to use. If your time tracking system is too complex, you're not going to use it.
Well, that's true.
It gets in the way.
Absolutely. But you know, also beyond that, and I appreciate you sharing that about Clio, I have a couple clients that use Clio. They like it. And yet at the end of the day, when they're not billing enough, you know what I think it is? I think it's a lack of confidence. I think it is, and this is easy for me to say, but I believe that billing and capturing all your time, you have to be confident that you are creating value, that the total number of hours that you're going to have billed against this project is going to be met with the acceptance of the client, and that they're going to be willing to pay the bill. And that is why it goes back, in my estimation, that upfront conversation of managing expectations and understanding the value that is being created. And I, as fundamental as that is, I know a fair number of people who resist that.
Is this uncomfortable at times, or it could be? Put it this way. I think the perception is that it's going to be uncomfortable. It doesn't have to be.
Well, no, and if you have the so you're going to have one of two conversations. This is the way I'd look at it. You're going to have one of two conversations. You're either going to have the conversation with the client up front, where you walk them through the process, and this isn't to try to make it a charade and make it sound more complicated than it is, but you know that old expression, until you've walked in my shoes, you have no idea how complex it is. Well, until you sit down with a client and explain to them that this isn't just go to Google, copy a form, fill it out, and it's a 30-minute job. This actually requires some research and some cross-indexing, and these are the forms, this is the research, this is the output, this is probably 8 to 10 hours. Until you have that conversation, the client thinks this is an hour or two job, maybe three. Well, no, it isn't 3 hours, it's really 10 hours. So unless you tell the client up front, this is probably going to run somewhere between $3,800 and $5,200, If at that point they say, no, I'm not spending that kind of money, then at least you know you're not going to spend the time and have them upset. So if you don't have that conversation, then you're going to have the conversation on the back end when the bill is $5,200, or you've hedged your bets and you're only billing them $3,100 because you're going, I don't think they're going to really be up for paying $5,200. But somewhere in that process, you're either going to write off a bunch of work, or you're going to have one of two conversations that may seem uncomfortable. And I'd rather have the one up front where the client understands going in, this is a stand-up person and they're explaining it to me and I'm all on board.
One of the other things I'm seeing recently, more and more firms are billing twice a month. You know, so there's no big surprise at the end of the month that the client is getting a bill every 2 weeks. And I think
that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it goes a long way to addressing the issues that you're speaking about. Well, let's shift gears here for a second.
Okay.
Pardon me. The other big challenge that I've seen hosting this program for the last few years, but certainly since COVID, is the theme that gets repeated over and over again about how difficult it is to find staff, to hire post-COVID, to find people who want to work, in an environment such as the legal practice is these days. And so I'm curious as to, with your clients, are you seeing the same thing, and what trends are you seeing emerge from that challenge?
Well, there's no doubt that just about everyone, not just in the legal profession, but in just about every business type I'm aware of, have real challenges in not only recruiting and hiring really competent staff, but then retaining the people that they have on staff. If there's an answer to that, and it's not something most law firms want to hear about, but it's really having a culture within the firm that people love to be around and really are enthusiastic about their job. And I know that's easier said than done, but creating an open and honest environment where people feel mutual respect and a collegial environment, as opposed to this is just a job. Because if their attitude, if a staff member's attitude, or an attorney, an associate attorney's feeling as though they're just an expendable item, they're just a little more than a desk or a chair, that doesn't retain individuals any length of time. And that's why I've seen a fair number of individuals leave large law firms, because of the pressure and, frankly, the feeling that the attorneys were expendable, and they have fled to smaller firms.
I find it interesting because, back in a previous life, I worked in the food industry. I cooked for a living. And during COVID and afterwards, food service companies really were hit hard, and lots of them didn't survive or survived very short time. Because the workers didn't come back to work in the restaurant. And I kept hearing people say, nobody wants to work anymore. It's cheaper not to work than to work. And having worked in the restaurant business, I knew the answer really is that they didn't want to come back to the crappy job you were offering. If you had a job that if you had a job that delighted them and they were made to feel part of the family, and share in the financial success of the restaurant, you're not going to have any trouble retaining client or retaining staff. And the same is true, just as you said, with law firm. If you have an environment that attorneys and staff members want to come and be in and be a part of, that if you develop that culture, you're not going to have any difficulty. It's when, you know, you think of your employees as being expendable, or that they ought to be grateful that they have a job just because you pay them, and you pay them as little as you possibly can. That doesn't bode well for, as you said, recruiting and retaining staff.
You know, it's really interesting. I couldn't agree with you more. One of the things I have come to conclude over the last several years is that more than perhaps any other single thing in the success of a business, and I wouldn't have told you this 20 years ago, more than any single thing is culture. And most people, or many people, might roll their eyes and go, what? That sounds kind of foo-foo. That's pretty ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, back up. When I was a young man, if someone had said to me, young man, find a company that has the right culture, I would have thought, oh gosh, I am just so glad to be out of school. I just want someone to pay me a check.
Right.
But the realities are, until you have determined what your culture is going to be, you really don't know what kind of an organization you're going to have, whether it's a plumbing company or a law firm. And as one author said, your culture is the worst behavior you're willing to tolerate. And you might think, wow, that seems pretty indicting. Well, it's true. If you think that you are a firm that's enlightened and that you really aspire to respect people and pay them well, but in a staff meeting, one individual is able to berate another person, use foul language, get angry, tip over the water glass, so to speak, and nobody tells that individual that they are out of line, that's your culture.
Yeah, that's what you've been willing to accept.
That's what you're willing to accept. And so oftentimes we tend to think about culture as being some theoretical, conceptual idea that probably is better than we're actually practicing. But we need to focus on the fact that if we want a really great culture, culture is created by the amalgamation of the conduct of each person in the firm. And if one person only in that firm is obnoxious, untrusting, disrespectful, then that means that the firm is tolerating that, and that is the firm's culture. And that has to change, because that, my friend, is what drives people away.
And
I've seen it repeated times.
And given that culture, that's the kind of staff that you're going to attract.
Yes. But only retaining them probably for a short time,
right?
Because they will move on as quickly as something better comes along.
It's a self-defeating prophecy. You know, I saw this, or it manifested itself very clearly for me, you know, after COVID, when we started going to a more virtual environment, people started working more remotely. And I had a number of attorneys, several on this program, that didn't like the idea of remote work. Because I want to keep an eye on my employees. I want to make sure they're working when they're on the clock. And I can't do that if they're at home. And I always suggested, well, if that's your approach, you got a problem far greater than the fact that they're working remotely.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
You know, and it's part of that, the lack of culture that you talk of. Well, listen, Mark, I could spend the rest of the afternoon here chatting with you, but I want to give you time to do what you do best, and that's work with other firms. And along those lines, where can our listeners go to find out more about Coach Rockwell and what you provide and how you do it?
Well, thank you for that, Neil. So my website is coachrockwell.com. Pretty simple, coachrockwell.com. Anyone that goes there can get an ebook I wrote called 5 Pitfalls of the Job. and how to overcome them. Being a lawyer is tough and it's not easy work, but there are some things that a person can do that helps them overcome the pitfalls, help push back on the profession, if you will. I love working with law firm leadership teams. I work with individual attorneys one-on-one. So yes, I would welcome the opportunity to visit with any or all of the individuals that are listening to your podcast. And thanks again for having me on. I always enjoy visiting with you and catching up.
Well, I do as well, Mark. And I will tell our listeners that, you know, this ebook, it's one of the very few ebooks that I actually printed out. You know, you get a lot of ebooks and they go in a big folder and I probably have, well, I don't know how many dozens, if not hundreds of ebooks that I have. But I actually printed this one out because there were, I remember when I got it, there were a couple of points that really resonated with me. So I'm just going to tell our audience, you know, I got no dog in this fight. You know, there's no remuneration here. It's a very worthwhile thing to download, in my humble opinion. So you do well to visit Mark's site and take advantage of that. So end of,
well, thank you, Neil.
End of that. So Mark, thanks again for being a good friend and coming on the show. And I look forward to your next visit.
Okay, my friend. Take care.
You too.
Enjoy.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.